Welcome to the session, teaching the World Wars in France, New Approaches and Ideas. As you might have noticed, we are being taped, and that's going to result in some, sort of a slightly different way of operating. One thing, in case you didn't notice in the errata this morning, or when you got in, our commentator, unfortunately, had to return to France suddenly for personal reasons, so Annette Becker will not be here to do a comment, which just leaves more time for audience questions and discussion. So, we'll take the bright side of that. Since we are being taped, we'll ask that we have hand mics that we can give you. Raise your hand, and when you first ask a question or have a comment, introduce yourself, your name, and your institution, so that we have that on the tape. And what we'll do is, rather than a comment, we'll just open the floor to questions afterwards. I will also introduce all three speakers here at the beginning so that I don't have to keep running back and forth to the podium. So I think we're ready to go. Our first speaker today is Bruno Caban, who is the Donald and Mary Dunn Chair in Modern Military History at Ohio State University. He has his PhD from the Department of History in the Université Paris 1, Panthéon-Sorbonne, and has his habilitation in 2013 from the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales. He has a book in 2004, La Victoire Endeuillée, my French has just totally left me, La Sortie de Guerre des Soldats Français, and in 2014, last year, two books, one, The Great War and the Origins of Humanitarianism, 1918 to 1924, so on the far side of the war, and the second one on the near side of the war, Août 14, La France entre en guerre. So he will be our first speaker, and his paper today is about teaching the cultural history of World War I. Our second presenter is Martha Hanna, who is a professor of history at the University of Colorado Boulder, has her PhD from Georgetown University, and her first book was The Mobilization of Intellect, French Scholars and Writers During the Great War, and more recently, Your Death Would Be Mine, Paul and Marie Pierrot in the Great War, which is a book that I've used many times in teachings. It's a wonderful book. And today's talk, The Global History in a National Space, France as a Transnational Space, 1914 to 1918. And our third speaker, Mary Louise Roberts, PhD from Brown University, is now the Wharf Distinguished Lucie Aubrac Professor of History. That is so cool. I didn't know you the Lucie Aubrac. How do you get to do that?
Oh. You get to name your
Oh, that is so cool.
Justin Bieber was already taken.
Right, okay. Just to list the books, so we didn't go anywhere else, but Civilization Without the Sexes, Gender in Post-World War I Era, Disruptive Acts, The New Woman in the Fin de Siècle France, so she goes from post-World War I back to the Fin de Siècle, and then jumps way forward to What Soldiers Do, Sex in the American GI in World War II France, 1944-46, which won the George Lewis Beer Prize of the AHA, has gotten her lots of attention, not all of which she has wanted, and it's been translated into everything from, Czech to Chinese and Japanese. It's quite remarkable. And a current book, which I see you have right there, D-Day Through French Eyes, Memoirs of Normandy, 1944, the 2014 book. And her paper is called The Épinal Project, Researching the Lives of American GIs Buried in Épinal Military Cemetery. So please join me in welcoming our first speaker, Bruno Caban.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for the introduction, and thank you, Lou, for putting together this great panel. I'd like also to thank Martha, and with a friendly thought for Annette, who would have been delighted to be here with us and whom we miss today. My paper today is based on my personal experience as a French historian teaching in the US. In 2005, I arrived in the Department of History at Yale, at the height of the Iraq War, after almost 10 years spent in various French universities. In 2014, I moved to Ohio State as the Dunn Chair in Modern Military History, and I can still remember my first impressions as a newcomer in the US 10 years ago. The format of a seminar is so different from the seminaire in France, as you know. The importance of preparing the syllabus in advance before the beginning of a new semester. I mean, you don't want to teach with the wrong list of chapters or the wrong list of articles or with too much reading, or not enough reading, which is even worse for your students. The discovery of new students with a diversity of backgrounds for the first time. Students originally from the Balkans, from Asia, from Africa, some of whom at a direct expense of war as refugees or as veterans. And I've actually many veterans at Ohio State. Even 10 years later, I'm still impressed by the US students, by their energy, by their creativity, by their ability to think broadly and in an independent way, by the fact that students' participation in classes and in sections is probably easier and probably more natural in this country than in the French academic system for many reasons that we can discuss later. Anyway, since my very first semester at Yale, in the fall semester in 2005, I've taught a class for undergraduates called The Cultural History of World War I. This is not military history in the traditional sense, by an approach to history that examines both the concrete experience of war, the concrete experience of combat, and what historians now call the culture de guerre, cultures of war, collective representations that evolve in wartime and progressively disappear in the war's aftermath. So in the fall of 2005, I probably did not anticipate the challenges of teaching a class like the cultural history of World War I. So this is the topic of my paper today, the challenges of teaching the cultural history of a great war in a US academic institution, but also the stakes of teaching the cultural history of war and the teaching strategies that I've used or tried to use first at Yale and more recently at Ohio State. So the first point I would like to make is about the definition of the field. The definition of the field of military history in both countries, and maybe also the self-representation of those who teach military history in the US and in France. French academics, as you know, rarely use the notion of histoire militaire for many reasons, but they prefer now the notion of histoire de la guerre, or even le phénomène guerrier, to use Audouin Rousseau's words. So arriving from France in 2005, I came from a country where the history of war, especially the history of World War I, I must say, was and is still a vibrant and innovative field. There are many reasons for that. The opening of the Historial de la Grande Guerre in Perron in 1992, with its comparative approach, the use of wartime objects, such as toys, postcards, photographs or trench art as new sources, the extension of historical research to new domains, the history of the body, the history of intellectuals, the history of children, the history of private grief, the history of collective mourning, and so forth. In sum, I started working on my dissertation in the late 1990s, quite a long time ago, and had the feeling of being part of an exciting collective adventure. In US academia, the cultural history of war is often considered as a subfield, and sometimes just as a subfield of military history. Simply put, in the US academic world, as you know, military historians, for good and bad reasons, sometimes feel marginalized or the victims of blind prejudice on the part of non-military historians or mainstream historians who often dismiss what traditional military historians do as outdated. They seem to see cultural historians as representatives of that mainstream history who are trying to take over the field of military history, something that my OSU colleague and friend Mark Grimsley, specialist of US history, US Civil War, once summarized with the following words in a very nice article full of irony published on his blog in 1996, "Why Military History Sucks." And I can't imagine actually any of my French colleagues, specialists of World War I, will publish an article entitled "Pourquoi ça craint de faire l'histoire de la Première Guerre mondiale?" So what does it mean to teach the cultural history of war? What does this notion of cultural history actually mean? In their book, The Great War in History, Debates and Controversies, Jay Winter and Antoine Pro argue that the cultural history of war is both social and cultural. I think that Antoine says, social et culturel indissolublement. They call cultural history the third configuration, as you know, in the historiography of World War I, after the first configuration defined as military and diplomatic, and the second one, which is social history, basically the history from below, from the perspective of soldiers and civilians, instead of the point of view of generals or diplomats. Anyway, for Winter and Pro, and I quote, cultural history already existed within social history, so in the 60s and 70s, under terms such as mentality, opinion, or psychology. It is evident that cultural history was already in existence, but was not recognized as such. In reality, one could argue actually that cultural history is even more ancient than social history. Take the example of Marc Bloch, you know, and his path-breaking article on the rumors of invasion, Réflexions sur les fausses nouvelles de la guerre, published in 1921 in the Revue de Synthèse Historique. What Marc Bloch did at that time, the early 20s, was already a form of cultural history of World War I, and the rediscovery of Bloch's writings by Stéphane Audouin-Rousseau and later by Annette Becker in an edited volume, L'Histoire, la Guerre, la Résistance, has led to a redefinition of the continuities between the Marc Bloch of the early 1920s and the Marc Bloch of the mid-20s and the Annales School of the late 20s, or if you want, between Réflexions sur les fausses nouvelles de la guerre, published in 1921, and Les Rois Thaumaturges, published in 1924. There is a clearly continuity. That said, the field of cultural history of the Great War has obviously considerably changed and expanded since the 20s, and even since the reconfiguration of the third paradigm in the 1980s or 1990s, to use Pro's and Winter's terminology. So to sum up, cultural history now includes the history of cultural productions, such as war literature, war poetry, war cinema, war photography, war paintings, the topics of at least four chapters out of eight in Jay Winter's Sites of Memory, Sites of Mourning. The history of material culture, including Trenchard, studied by Nick Sanders and many other specialists of cultural anthropology. The history of collective representations, for instance, Stéphane Audouin-Rousseau and Annette Becker, and of course in their path-breaking 1914-1918 Understanding the Great War. The cultural memory of the Great War, studied by Dan Sherman, for instance, in his Construction of Memory in Interwar France, 1999, with a definition, as you know, of memory, very different from Nora's Lieu de Mémoire. And lastly, the history of the self, history of intimacy, the history of everything that lies at the core of a person, the inner space where self-image is formed through the body and gestures, the inner space where relationships to others, emotions and feelings are shaped. So we could think of the growing importance of personal archives in the writing of cultural history, for instance, the use of wartime correspondences. And I wanted to say that first. I mean, I wanted to say that actually I use Martha's book all the time. So please, I mean, that was also in my book. So yes, of course, I use Martha's superb book, Your Death Will Be Mine, for my students every single year. So far we've already identified at least two different traditions of cultural history based on two different definitions of the word culture, one that derives from, say, the history of art and identifies culture as with cultural productions. And in a way, you know, Paul Fussell, himself a professor of 18th century English literature, is probably the best example of his school of cultural history with his book, The Great War and Modern Memory. And the other tradition, which derives from historical anthropology, and uses a broader definition of the word culture as a system of collective representations, mentalities, and norms. So in teaching the cultural history of World War I, the first challenge, I think, is to introduce students to this broader definition of war culture or culture history. Many of my students know a little bit about British war poetry. They know some war movies about World War I, sometimes Lewis Milestone's All Quiet on the Western Front, more often Peter Weir's Gallipoli, and sometimes Christian Carion's Joyeux Noël, which is not that good. What they usually don't know is that World War I was also a war of words and images. It's not what they don't realize that words and images are essential to understand World War I. That the Great War was in many ways, and since the very beginning actually of the conflict, a defensive war in every country, and that the notion of culture itself was often at the very center of the fight. For the French, civilization meant the heritage of the French Revolution and the role played by France in the end of the 18th century to promote the ideals of enlightenment. For the British and the Americans, culture was a way of life, traditions of freedom, the traditions of freedom of speech, the tradition of liberty of trade, and for the Germans, the notion of Kultur expressed the superiority of their country over the old nations, France and Britain, with their backward-looking values and their limited and materialistic ambitions. In each of these countries, the war became a fight to defend their nation's culture, which had come under attack from uncultured barbarians of enemy nations. When I teach the cultural history of World War I, I often start with the definition of culture in wartime. And I ask the following questions. What was at stake in World War I? Why did soldiers and civilians hold out? And when I say soldiers, I don't mean only the French soldiers and the Franco-French debate about consenting to the war. Please don't ask me questions about that. We are not in the no man's land. We are outside the no man's land. The culture is certainly a major component of the soldiers' resilience and their consent to the conflict. In the US, many students have studied the soldiers' motivations in World War II, but they don't know much about the culture of World War I. And what I found especially difficult to teach is the cultural experience of invasion, the cultural experience of occupation, which is deeply rooted in the collective memory of Northern France or Belgium, you know, thinking of, you know, Stéphane Odorozo told me many times that, you know, when you teach history of World War I to the students in Picardy, it means something. That's their history for sure. And it's of course a big difference with the US. So in teaching the culture history of World War I, the second challenge I think is to introduce students to a new chronology of the conflict, or to put it in other words, and this is very, very important, I think, to show them that the chronology of the Great War, and actually the chronology of any conflict, is not just the chronology of military operations or a succession of dates, victories, and defeats. From the perspective of cultural history, the summer of 1914 is obviously the first key moment. In my classes, I use, of course, Horn and Kramer's German atrocities, and I try to emphasize the speed and the intensity of cultural mobilizations, a topic that I've also studied in my master's in Burgundistan. You mentioned Août 14, published by Gallimard in 2014. The point is to show students how wartime atrocities committed in the very first weeks of the conflict, a reality that most students identify with World War II and not with World War I, became integrated almost immediately into wartime cultures. I examined the different kinds of cultural mobilizations, from the manifesto of the 93 German intellectuals in October 1914 to the use of German atrocities on wartime posters or cartoons. Teaching the cultural history of World War I leads me also to examine another turning point in the history of the war, the year 1916. Which I identify as a moment when civilians on the armed fronts, or at least some of them, could no longer accept to any sanitized representation of the conflict. And I usually take two examples to show that public expectations had changed by 1916. The first one is, of course, Le Feu, published, as you know, under fire in the French newspaper L'Oeuvre at the end of 1916 and later as a book, and he used these covers as a way to show them, the actual covers of the Flammarion edition, and I have them at home, so I can also show them the copies, the realistic representation of death, which even for students who see death represented all the time now, you know, in the news and everywhere, it's still something very shocking. And I try to show them that once again, it's a turning point in the representation of World War One. The other turning point is, I think, the release of the first ever war film documentary, The Battle of the Somme, shot by two cameramen, Malins and McDowell, in the fall of 16, when the film ended its run. It had been seen in Britain by an estimated 20 million people. So in my classes, I emphasize the fact that in 1916, the documentary was really a national event in Britain, and that the movie had a huge impact on the cultural representations of the conflict and the discovery of a new reality of war by civilians on the armed front. The crisis of 17 and the remobilization of 1918, to use John Horne's words, are two other key moments in the chronology of the cultural history of World War One. But I would like to underline, and you won't be surprised, the importance of the notion of cultural demobilization, both as a concept, introduced by John Horne, as you know, in 2001, and as a tool to understand the reconfiguration of war cultures in the aftermath of World War One. Too often, as you know, historians of war have studied conflicts as historical events with clearly defined beginnings and clearly defined ends, like Armistice Day on November 11, 1918, or the signing of the Peace Treaty of Versailles on June 20, 1919. The point about cultural history, I think, is to study the breaks and continuities between war and peace. What I think we should think of as the porous boundaries between war and peace. So what I usually do in my classes on the cultural history of the Great War is to show students the complexities of individual and collective attitudes towards former enemies in the aftermath of World War One, and I use the example of Jacques Rivière, the editor of the editor-in-chief of the NRF from 1919 until his death in 1925. You know the story, most probably. I mean, Rivière was mobilized in the 220th Infantry. He was captured on August 24th, 1914. He was sent to a POW camp in Saxony, where he heard from his sister Isabelle of Alain Fournier's death, his brother-in-law and best friend. In the summer of 17, he became seriously ill and he was transferred to Switzerland, where he spent the rest of the war. And he started pleading the cause of an international organization which will eventually become the League of Nations. This may be seen as a kind of cultural demobilization before the end of the war itself. Yet in the spring of 18, after the Ludendorff offensive on the Western Front, he published a short text entitled L'Allemand in the German, in which he denounced the German mentality, the German Kultur, as notoriously uncivilized. And I quote him, "What I reproach the Germans for is not primarily their deeds. My complaint is more profound. It is their very being that I hate, or rather the void of their being. What I resent most in the Germans is that they are nothing." Remobilization. Clearly. In June 1919, he wrote an article in the NRF defending the demobilization of the war. It's the title. Demobilization of the mind, sorry. Demobilization of the mind. Yet, when L'Allemand, the German, was published in a new edition in 1924, in 1924 he did not distance himself in his forewords from what he had previously written about the Germans in the spring of 1918, which can be seen as a kind of remobilization once again. So it's sometimes extremely difficult to determine any coherence in the veterans' changing attitudes towards their former enemies, at least in the early 20s. Put otherwise, once again, teaching the cultural history of war, especially the cultural history of World War One, can encourage, I think, our students to adopt a new approach to the chronology of the war, to see the history of the war not as a series of events, but as a series of evolution, as a series of conflicting movements of mobilization, demobilization, and remobilization. There are several difficulties specific to the teaching of the cultural history of the Great War in the US, one of them being the bibliography itself. Many important books on the cultural history of World War I, especially on the cultural history of World War I France, are not accessible in English translation. Thank God we have 1418 Understanding the Great War and the textbook on France and the Great War by Lan Smith, Stéphane de Marozo, and Anne Becker. And that's it. The other issue for US teachers is the difficulty of sending students to visit the battlefields or war museums in Europe. I envy our students who work on the US Civil War. But most museums now have amazing websites with tremendous resources. Many US universities have their own collection of World War I posters accessible online. You know, some of them, like the collections of the Hoover Institute or the Beinecke Library at Yale, are accessible online. Given these difficulties, which have often resulted in the kind of unfamiliarity of US students with World War I, one important outcome of teaching the cultural history of war is to provoke a reaction of surprise among students, a movement of distanciation from preconceived ideas about the war. And that will be actually my conclusion. The reaction of surprise may come from this cotton embroidery made by a French PLW in 1918, which he represents his own homecoming, dressed with his ruby red pants of 1914. Which is, by the way, a way to include my military guys who know the ruby red pants, who are not so much interested in the cultures of World War I, but you know, if you recognize that, then progressively you come to a different level, which is, of course, a kind of confrontation of two moments of the war. And this, it's fascinating, just take 2 seconds, but got my, yes. Oh, sorry, come back. Okay, so, of course, what is fascinating, and it will have been fascinating for Annette too, you know, he presents himself as l'exilé, you know, it's Annette's definition of POWs in World War I, someone in exile, you know, far away from his country, of course, but far away from his country at war. 1914, 15, 16, 17, 18, which shows the length, of course, the endless duration of the conflict, the homecoming. And once again, an idealization, what I like here is that this young girl is probably less than 4 years old. So, and she recognizes her father all the same, or, you know, so it's absolutely fascinating. So that's a wonderful representation, and you can't do much with that, I think. The second example I wanted to give is this wonderful object, which is also a way to create a kind of surprise among students. It's a beautiful pendant, a shrapnel ball, removed from the body of a wounded soldier, sent to his wife and enclosed in a golden frame and sent back by the soldier's fiancé as a kind of talisman. So once again, fascinating story to understand the relationships between the armed front and the front line, to understand the importance of the soldier's religion, to understand, well, many things, how you transform matter, how you transform objects of death into something else. So lastly, I think the reaction of surprise, and that was really my last word, may even come from a film as well known as The Grand Illusion. Why? Well, because for the generation of our students used to the realistic representation of war violence, like Saving Private Ryan, for instance, or Band of Brothers, to use only 2 examples of World War II, it is surprising to discover a film of the 30s with no representation of trench warfare. So Grand Illusion can be ranked, of course, among the most famous pacifist films of interwar period, though it does not actually show any scene of war violence. If you, of course, you can feel the war violence, but you know, it's not even All Quiet on the Western Front. So I usually end my class with what Francis Ford Coppola once said in an interview about Apocalypse Now. Is what Francis Ford Coppola said about Apocalypse Now, and that can be used, I think, for The Grand Illusion. To make a film that is truly anti-war, it will not be set anywhere near battlefields or theaters of war, but rather in human relations far from those. And I think it's a very, very good point. Thank you.